How many people here feel we should go to war against Iraq? Yeah, don't be shy. Okay. Don't feel bad. There are other people out there who agree with you. You know, but not as many as a lot of people think. I believe that the feeling, whether expressed or unexpressed, against the war is much, much greater in the United States than has been reported in the papers or than is evidenced by, you know, the figures they give you in the polls. I really believe that. I say that on the basis of going around the country and speaking to a lot of groups. And I don't always speak to groups who are already for, you know, getting, you know, a peace in the world and against war. I speak to a lot of high school assemblies where, you know, young people who are forced to come into the assembly. You know what high schools are like. They're totalitarian places. And the students are just herded into this auditorium to listen to me. And most of them are like most high school students. They get their news from television. All they see on the television is, you know, who do they see? Well, you know those faces. You know, Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney and all of those, and they don't have access usually to other kinds of information, and you know, they're getting recruiting speeches and military people coming to the high schools. You know, in high schools there's a lot of militarism, and there's a lot of a lot of machismo and all of that. So I've talked to a lot of high school assemblies like that, what I find is this: that when these students who have been given all the orthodox information, when they begin to get some different kinds of information, and when they're asked some questions which they hadn't thought about before, in other words, when their orthodox train of thought is interrupted in some sense and they have to think about something else, people have second thoughts. And people begin to reconsider. I've seen this again and again and again. And I think that's why there's been a growing sentiment against the war. If you notice, even the support for the war, even though it still seems to remain high, has gone down and down and down. And I attribute that to the fact that gradually, little by little, more and more information has been coming out, more and more opposition reported. And I mean, this is what happened during the Vietnam War. Beginning of the war, 2/3 of the population in favor of the war. 3-4 years later, 2/3 of the population against the war. Of course, that took several years. That's why this administration wants to hurry. And, you know, this is what they learned from Vietnam. They learned from Vietnam, if you're going to have a war, do it fast. Get it over with before there's time for a movement against the war to develop. So it's a race between the war makers and the people who are opposed to war. Anyway, all of this, since most of you seem to be opposed to the war, what can I tell you? I suppose I can only tell you things that you can tell other people. Maybe a lot of things I tell you will be things you already know, right? But, you know, we have to say these things again and again and again. And I guess I can just, you know, tell you about the kind of things I talk to people about, which were the kind of things I talk to high school audiences about, because all of us are teachers, all of us have people to talk to, all of us have, you know, our neighbors, our fellow students, the people we work with, our families, all of us can write letters to newspapers, all of us can call in on talk shows, which are bad, usually, and which need some rebel callers to call in. All of us have an opportunity to change the thinking of people by talking to them. And so, in a way, where, you know, I'm sort of exchanging ideas with you about how to talk with people about the war. I mean, to me, one of the most important things is for people to learn a little history. Because Well, if you don't know history, it's as if you were born yesterday. If you were born yesterday, then anybody in authority can get up before the microphones, get up before the television cameras, and tell you anything. We are now facing the greatest evil in world history. We are facing Hitler again. We are facing this monster military machine which may attack us at any moment, which is a clear and present danger, which is building up weapons of mass destruction and led by a tyrant who is unlike anybody else in the world. And this is why we must go to war. Well, if you knew some history, you would know something about all the other times in the United States when leaders of the country have gotten up before the public and said, we must go to war for this reason or that reason or the other reason. You would know about all those times. You would know about all the lies and deceptions that took place in this country given to the American people by the leaders of the country. There was a great journalist who is now dead, one of the great journalists of the 20th century, I.F. Stone. I don't know if you heard of him, but if any of you go to journalism school or study journalism, maybe his name might come up, because he's one of those rare independent journalists who broke away from the major media and set up his own little newsletter and would tell people things that they give them data they couldn't get anywhere else. And he became rather well known and as a result of this kind of remarkable independent muckraking journalism. And he would go to classes and assemblies of journalism students to talk to would-be reporters, and he would say, look, only two words you should know if you really want to be an honest journalist. Two words: governments lie. And if you know anything of the history of this country, and other countries, by the way, our government isn't the only government that lies. Governments lie, generally. It's just that, we're better than anybody. We are number one. We have the most to gain, the most to lose, the most at stake. And when you have the most to gain, the most to lose, the most at stake, the most wealth, the tendency is your lies will be bigger than anybody else's and more dangerous. But yes, there is a history of deception and lies of presidents. President Polk in the Mexican War. Hope you don't mind my going back that far. But I'll eventually come forward. In a few hours, I'll come back to today, you see. But, Mexican War, always something happens, you see, which becomes a cause for war. And the President of the United States gets up before the they didn't have television cameras, but he makes statements which are carried in the press and by telegraph and so on. And he says, the Mexicans have fired on us. They've shed blood on American soil, American, and so on and so forth. Not quite true. Soldiers sent into disputed territories a clash with Mexican soldiers. American soil? Not quite. It didn't matter. Soon we were at war with Mexico. A war which had been planned in advance, which didn't need that clash on the border, but, well, it needed it only as a way of getting the American public to say, oh, yes, look what they did to us. We must respond. But, of course, even long before that incident, the government of the United States had its eye on Mexico. Why? It wanted half of Mexico. A modest demand. It could have wanted all of Mexico. But no, a short war took half of Mexico. I mean, why do we have California and Arizona and Nevada? I mean, that was Mexican territory. Why do you have all those Spanish names out there, right? I mean, it's ironic. Now we determined to keep the Mexicans out of this territory, right? And build a wall along the southern border of California to keep the Mexicans out of the land that we stole from them in 1848, you see. But the lie historically, you go into the Spanish-American War, they blew up the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor. The Spaniards did it, and therefore we have to go to war. Well, nobody knew who blew up the battleship Maine, but it doesn't matter. The government has told us that. We believe the government is, you know, right. There's this myth long perpetuated. These people up there, they know more than we do. Very often they do know more than we do. But they don't tell us the truth of what they know. They tell us other things. Well, in the 1970s, they sent an investigating commission to really go into the battleship Maine incident. They found out it was an internal explosion that caused the sinking of the battleship Maine. Didn't matter. It was too late, right? We had already gone into Cuba to fight against Spain. Again, the avowed purpose, liberate Cuba from Spain, which Cuba needed, in fact. Cuba had been oppressed by Spain. And, this is a noble thing to do. We're always doing noble things in the world, always liberating people, helping people against their oppressors. The Boy Scouts of the world, helping other people across the street, you know. So we go into Cuba, fight Spain, get Spain out of Cuba, liberate the Cubans from Spain, but not from us. Then Spain is out, the United States moves in. American corporations move in, American railroads move in, American banks move in, and Cuba is ours. And we rewrite the Cuban Constitution so that it has a clause enabling us to move into Cuba anytime we want, which we did again and again and again. After the Spanish-American, a few years after, almost immediately after the Spanish-American War, which was a little war. They called it a splendid little war. That was John Hay, our member of the cabinet, called it a splendid little war. You know, only a splendid definition of a splendid little war is you have very few casualties. The other side has many, but you don't care about the other side. You only care about your side. Actually, there were thousands of Americans who died, soldiers who died in the Spanish-American War, but not from combat, from disease, from illness, caused by the sale of rotten beef to the soldiers by meatpacking companies in Chicago. Really interesting little footnote to the Spanish-American War. But that was a little war. Then we fight a war in the Philippines. And why? To civilize the Filipinos. To Christianize them. Right? And unlike the Spanish American, unlike the war in Cuba, this is a bloody war that lasts for years. Years. A war in which close to 1 million Filipinos are killed in order to establish American control over the Philippines against the desire of the Filipinos to run their own country. A war filled with massacres and atrocities. At one point toward the end of the war in the Philippines, 1906, the war had started in 1899. This is not a little, short, splendid war, no. In 1906, a massacre takes place. American soldiers go into a southern island of the Philippines and they attack a group of Moros, of Muslim Filipinos who are living on this island, people living in the Stone Age, really. People have no weapons. And they attack them and kill every man, woman, and child, 600 people. The President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt, sends a message of congratulations to the military commander for a great military victory. Mark Twain speaks up and denounces Roosevelt. You don't usually hear about Mark Twain's anti-imperialism when you study, literature history. You hear about Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer. Don't usually hear about Mark Twain as the leader of the Anti-Imperialist League. And usually Theodore Roosevelt is presented as a great hero. You'll notice how many of our recent presidents have Theodore Roosevelt's picture up there, and how in every list of great presidents, Theodore Roosevelt, the racist, the warmonger, really, the congratulator of massacres, how he is one of the top 10. any list of great presidents. There is Theodore Roosevelt up there, and his, you know, he's carved in rock on, right, on Mount Rushmore. Very hard to get him off. I've been trying. I've been working on it. It's a class project, maybe. That's just part of it, you know. I'm going back that far just to show you how far back the deceptions go. And they go into World War I, they go into the Korean War, and they go into, you know, and there's always a good cause that's presented to the American public. World War I, oh, we're being attacked by German submarines. The Kaiser is the most evil man in the world. The German Kaiser at that time in World War I played the same role in American public opinion that Saddam Hussein plays today. I mean, you should have seen the caricatures of the Kaiser and the stories of the cruelties of the Kaiser and how we must get rid of the Kaiser. If we get rid of the Kaiser, everything will be okay. So we get into World War I. And the Kaiser is gone. And 10 million men are dead on the battlefields of World War I. And at the end of it, people look around and ask, what have we done? You know, and what have we accomplished? You know, and the devastation of Germany in World War I has something to do with the rise of Hitler in 1933. There are unforeseen consequences of so-called necessary wars. Consequences which you cannot see at the time. Sometimes it's referred to as blowback. You get hold of a book written a few years ago by Chalmers Johnson called Blowback. And it's all about this phenomenon of how, you know, you take military action here or there, presumably for some good purpose, and the consequences come back at you in a way that you could not predict. Korea... Good. Very often there are, you know, things, real things that happen that are unjust that you feel you should do something about. The only question that's not asked is whether the thing you should do about it is war. North Korea invades South Korea in 1950. Yes, bad, unjust, wrong. The only question is then the proper remedy to go to war, which we did in Korea for 3 years, and what are the results? 2 to 3 million Koreans killed. Napalm used all over Korea. Villages devastated. Massacres taking place. At the end of 3 years of war, where did we come out? Exactly where we were when the war started. A dictatorship in North Korea, a dictatorship in South Korea. Only 2 to 3 million people are dead. Now, of course, there's the Vietnam War, which... You know, for numbers of lies told around wars, probably no historical episode exceeds the Vietnam War. Now, again, a precipitating incident. Again, lies told. Again, so this is why we must go to war. They've attacked our destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin. Immediately. Well, does the public know where the Gulf of Tonkin is? Does the president know where the Gulf of Tonkin is? Do the members of Congress know? You know, they've attacked our destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin. Of course, nobody asks, what were our destroyers doing in the Gulf of Tonkin? Is the Gulf of Tonkin off the coast of San Francisco? You know, where is the Gulf of Tonkin? It's off the coast of Vietnam. Is it possible that our destroyers were engaged in aggressive action in the, off the coast of Vietnam? Well, it turns out that no, our destroyers were not fired upon in the Gulf of Tonkin. That the things happened, radar flashes on the radar screen, and nobody could show any damage to the American ships. Not a scratch. No, nobody. No. At one point, a congressman who was supporting the going to war as a result of the Gulf of Tonkin was asked, well, how come if they attacked us, there are no signs of any damage to American vessels? And I swear this was his answer. Well, those Chinese are very clever. Really, Chinese, Vietnamese, you know, they're all, you know, all the same. You know. It turned out, of course, later that everything that was said about the Gulf of Tonkin was a lie. Like, the Secretary of Defense issued a statement to the press in which five different lies were uttered in two sentences, you know. But it didn't matter. Congress immediately rushed to approve the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and we were at war. You know. Again, surrounded by phrases of, you know, this tyrant Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh was the enemy. There's always a, you know, an enemy of the year. Really, you know, it's the Kaiser, it's Ho Chi Minh. Of course, there was Hitler, and that was real, but then everybody else becomes Hitler. You know, all they have to do is say that somebody is like Hitler, and no more questions are asked. I mean, and if somebody suggests that anybody on our side is like Hitler, well, they'd better watch their step. We go to war in Vietnam, surrounded by phrases, we're fighting for democracy, we're fighting against communism, we're fighting against communist world domination, because if the communists win in North Vietnam, they will dominate, you know, communism will dominate the world. People didn't bother to look at the map. China was already a communist country. Soviet Russia was already a communist country. Here is little Vietnam. If Vietnam becomes communist, that's the end. I mean, it's amazing what they get away with. Amazing. Well, it's like, you know, our war in Grenada. Grenada is a threat. Do you know where Grenada is? Do you know how big Grenada is? Do you know what Grenada is? Grenada is a threat to the United States. We have to send troops in, kill. We won't kill a lot of people. But then Panama, another enemy of the year. Noriega, right? Remember we go into Panama, send the troops into Panama. We invade Panama. Notice how we are against invasions of other countries by somebody else, sometimes, but not by us. We invade Panama. We kill we don't know how many people. A few thousand people in Panama? No, what's a few thousand people if they're Panamanians? How many, and destroy neighborhoods, because Noriega has to be, you know. And we got him, unlike Osama bin Laden. We got Noriega. And we wanted to get Noriega because Noriega was he was responsible for the drug trade in the Western Hemisphere, really. So we catch him and we put him in prison. And you notice how the drug trade has disappeared? You know? Think if we catch Osama bin Laden, terrorism will disappear. If we destroy Saddam Hussein and Iraq, you think terrorism will disappear in the world? No. All that talk accompanying wars, all those deceptions, people need to be reminded of the history of governmental deception in order to just begin to critically examine the things that are being said today. And then you have to look closely at, you know, I suppose at here's another historical thought. You see. Terrorism is the center of our attention. Everything we do now is about terrorism. And everything we do now can be justified because we've got to do something about terrorism. Actually, terrorism is just the latest in a series of sort of targets which, if attacked, will solve problems. You know, there's always a target, you know, and always a reason, always a phrase, always a justification. In the 19th century, It was manifest destiny. You know, in the, at the turn of the century, it was, you know, bringing civilization to this, you know, these people and those people. In the period of the Cold War, of course, it was communism. Now, there's a reality to some of these things. There was a reality to communism. Just as today, there's a reality to terrorism. Terrorism really exists. Communism really exists. However, what happens is that something which is real is magnified in its danger to everybody else in such a way that everything that happens in the world is then attributed to this. So that if the newly elected president of Guatemala in 1954 nationalizes the land of United Fruit, takes over the land of United Fruit, this is part of the world communist conspiracy. Anything you do against United Fruit must be communist. And so, you know, we engineer a coup, right, and get rid of the president and put into office, this is called, what is it called? It's called regime change. We change the regime of Guatemala to get the confiscator of United Fruit lands out of there and to put in who? A series of military dictators who carry on terror campaign against their own people, especially the indigenous people of Guatemala, in the course of which maybe 200,000 people die. We are masters at regime change. And that was done in the name of communism, just as, you know, when we overthrew the government of Chile, again, an elected, democratically elected government in Chile in 1973, it was because of communism. Now, none of these situations had anything to do with communism. The confiscation of nationalization of oil in Iraq in 1953 had nothing to do with communism, but communism was always the reason. Communism, communism everywhere. And communism became the thing that terrorism is today. It became a justification for doing whatever you wanted. And what does the United States want? Does it really want to get rid of terrorism? Is that really the motive? Was getting rid of communism the real motive of the United States when it changed the government in Guatemala, changed the government in Chile, when it went to war in Vietnam? Was that really the motive? No. Was communism really the motive for supporting the Contras in Nicaragua, supporting the death squads in El Salvador? Communism really the reason for supporting dictatorships all over Central America and Southeast Asia and the Middle East and so on? It was useful. But it wasn't the real reason, just as terrorism isn't the real reason. Notice how successful we have been in dealing with terrorism by bombing Afghanistan. How many people think about this? We've been bombing Afghanistan. I mean, next time somebody says, you know, well, you know, way to get rid of terrorism is to bomb this place and that place or the other place. Okay, we've been bombing Afghanistan for a year. Do we feel safer today? We feel more secure today? And then the more things happen around the world, which are, and they don't know what Al-Qaeda did or not, but they're acts of terrorism, you know. What have we done in Afghanistan? We've devastated a country already devastated by years and decades of war. You know, drove a million people out of their homes in the course of this bombing, killed several thousand people in the name of fighting terrorism, when we had no idea where the terrorists were, who they are, or whether the bombing would do anything at all about terrorism. There must be some motive behind that, and I suggest what it is, you know. It's not hard to figure out. There's a common denominator to manifest destiny and the fight to and wars to civilize other people and wars to end all wars, as in World War I, a common denominator. Wars to, you know, bring democracy and self-determination to South Vietnam, and now the war. The common denominator to all these wars, surrounded by slogans which begin to fall apart as soon as you examine some of the facts. And I suggest the common denominator is simply the drive to expand American power throughout the world. I mean, you can trace that from the Revolutionary War on. Remember, we first conquered a continent. It wasn't empty. There were Indians living here. There were Native Americans living here. We moved ruthlessly across this continent, exterminating Indian tribes, moved into Mexico. Continental expansion, and then expansion into the Caribbean, and then expansion into the Pacific. And after World War II, expansion into the Middle East. And now, with the war in Afghanistan, an opportunity to expand even further into Central Asia. Now, well, we've always had troops all over the world. Now we have troops in more places. We always had troops in over 100 countries. Now we have troops in 130 countries. Since the war in Afghanistan, we've been able to put military bases in, well, not only in Afghanistan, but in, well, these countries of Central Asia, Turkmenistan, as you know, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. I suggest that when you look behind the slogans of communism and terrorism and, you know, and all the things that are told to us, what you find is the drive to expand. And it isn't, I don't think it's very hard for people to see this once you point out to them the history. Well, the history of Western imperial expansion. The United States was not the first. The United States is one of the last. Well, let's hope it's the last. But the United States, I mean, they were all the empires. I mean, this is what civilization, right? What is called the modern era, the era of Western civilization. The era of Western civilization coincides with imperial conquest of the world by the various empires, by the Spanish and the Portuguese and the Dutch and the German and the Russian and the Japanese and, of course, the British Empire, and then, after World War II, the American Empire. I believe that is really what is happening, despite all the talk about terrorism and, you know, if they really, really cared about terrorism, they wouldn't simply rush to bomb the first helpless country that they can bomb. Really. When you think about it, here is the most mighty military power in the world singling out Afghanistan to bomb, singling out Iraq to bomb. You know, something is going on there. If they really cared, if they really responded to terrorism, wanted to, they'd sit down and think. But you know, there was no thinking, no caring to think. Terrible thing happens on 9/11, a terrorist attack, a devastating, horrible, cruel event. And Bush immediately takes advantage of the emotions roused by that to say, we're at war. We're at war against terrorism. And now we're going to start bombing Afghanistan because we've got to do something. You know, and very often you hear when you say, why are we responding to terrorism by bombing a country when we have no idea what that will do? People say, well, you've got to do something. How often have you heard that? You've just got to do something. In the Hippocratic Oath that doctors take, there's a kind of principle that is put forth, and the principle is if you don't know what to do in a situation, a medical situation, you're faced with a medical situation, the first principle is you don't really know what to do, but the first principle is do no harm. War is harm. War is great harm. So I think we need to teach history. The history of wars, the history of deceptions, the history of slogans, the history of real motives. Yeah, I think we have to do that. And we have to examine the claims that are made, you know. There's a tyrant and he has tyrannized his own people and he's gassed the Kurds. All of this is true, of course. as if he is the only tyrant. As if there aren't tyrants all over the world, many of them put in power by the United States. As if there aren't countries which have done devastating things to their own people, like the government of Turkey, which has killed thousands, tens of thousands of Kurds. But Turkey is our ally. It can do what it wants. Saudi Arabia can behave towards its women like the Taliban behaved, but Saudi Arabia is our ally, so that's okay. Saudi Arabia will let us do what we want with its oil. Saddam Hussein will not let us do what we want with his oil. Weapons of mass destruction. I don't think I've heard a set of words used more often in the press and coming out of the White House than, that mantra. Again and again and again. Weapons of mass destruction. Until, the public is led to believe there is one country in the world where there exists weapons of mass destruction which are aimed at us. Well, Saddam Hussein may very well develop one nuclear weapon within 2 or 5 years. That's what the intelligence estimates, our own intelligence estimates even, but there's very often a disjunction between what the government tells you publicly and what the CIA says, may develop a nuclear weapon 2 to 5 years. There are 8 countries in the world that possess nuclear weapons. Israel has 200 nuclear weapons. Pakistan and India have nuclear weapons. Pakistan and India almost went to war using nuclear weapons. I mean, talk about, weapons of mass destruction. And what country in the world possesses more weapons of mass destruction than the United States of America? What country has used weapons of mass destruction, including chemical weapons? What country has used weapons of mass destruction more devastatingly than the United States? There's amazing hypocrisy going on here about weapons of mass destruction. We are the only country in the world. In mid-October, in mid-September, September 12th, I got a letter from Kurt Vonnegut. He sent me a copy. How many people here like Kurt Vonnegut? Okay, that helps. But he and I have become friends in the last few years. We have things in common. He sent me a copy on, this was September 12th, just recently, and it was, the anniversary, September 11th, and everybody was talking about, it's the anniversary of September 11th, and terrorism, and weapons of mass destruction, and so on and so forth. Sent me a copy of a fax that he sent that day, September 12th, copy of a fax he sent to the New York Times, to the editors, letter to the editors of the New York Times. Well, this is what his letter said. It's very short, but very Vonnegut-like. this is the way he talks, thinks, He says things in his own oblique, ironic way, And this basically, I don't think I'm getting more, the one or two words different, but this is basically what he said. Not hard to remember, it's so short. He said in his letter to the New York Times, this: there is only one country in the world which has dropped nuclear weapons on other people, turning 200,000 people to dust and ashes. That was his letter. New York Times did not print it. Now, sometimes you think, the New York Times isn't going to print my letter, but because who am I? Well, who is Kurt Vonnegut, right? The New York Times would not print that letter. That tells you a lot about the freedom of the press and all the news that's fit to print and the control of the media and so on. But So, you know, all this stuff about, you know, this is the tyrant. Here are the weapons of mass destruction. A clear and present danger? No. That phrase, clear and present danger, which entered our vocabulary in World War I, you know, in the Supreme Court, it's amazing what you can do with that phrase. All you have to do is say this is a clear and present danger, and people won't ask whether it really is a clear and present danger. In World War I, some of you who studied a little history of that time may recall that laws were passed. There's a law called the Espionage Act, which really didn't have to do with espionage. It just made it a criminal offense for people to criticize the war. You would think, oh, we have the First Amendment to the Constitution, right? You're supposed to be able to criticize anything, free speech and all of that. Forget it. The Supreme Court is, in time of war, falls prostrate on its face, really, prostrate. Maybe prostate also, I don't know. I haven't examined them too closely. But the Supreme Court, yeah. There's this guy in World War I, 1917, who's distributing leaflets against entering the war, against the draft. And his case, they arrest him under the Espionage Act, you know, and he says, what about the First Amendment, freedom of speech? He goes up to the Supreme Court. Unanimous decision against him that he has to go to jail, 10 years in prison for distributing leaflets. And the decision is given by Oliver Wendell Holmes, the great liberal jurist. You know, the word liberal has to be looked on very, very carefully. Liberal, you know, famous, intellectual, one of the great members of the Supreme Court. And Oliver Holmes writes this opinion, sending him to jail for 10 years. Why? Because he is a clear and present danger. Imagine. A leaflet. A guy who distributes leaflets on the street against the draft is a clear and present danger. Woodrow Wilson, the president, is not a clear and present danger. The man who is sending American troops to their deaths in Europe, he's not a clear and present danger. The guy who distributes leaflets is a clear and present danger. And now Saddam Hussein. Oh, I must tell you one more thing about that period. It's one of my favorite periods of American history because it reveals so much. One of the people prosecuted in World War I under the Espionage Act was a filmmaker. He made a film about the American Revolution. You may recall that in the American Revolution, the British were our enemies, right? So he makes a film about the American Revolution in which the British are our enemies. But this is World War I. The British are now our allies. Can't do that. They arrest him under the Espionage Act. He's sentenced to 10 years in prison for making this film. Affirmed by the Supreme Court. The name of his film is The Spirit of 76. The name of the court case is U.S. versus Spirit of 76. You know. Well, I think we have to, in talking to other people, question what is an accepted premise very often, that it's good for the United States to be the number one superpower in the world. You know, makes us proud. We are number one. The question is, what are we number one in? In military strength, yes. In gross national product, yes. Very gross. That's what we're number one. But we're not number one in reducing infant mortality. We're not number one in health care. We're not number one in education. We're not number one in any number of social indicators that tell us how people in this country are living. No. I just read an item that I got about how in California the health system is falling apart. There's no money in the health system. And people, you know, the emergency wards are crowded with people waiting 12 hours and 16 hours to get treated. There's no money for health, you know. Something wrong there. seems to me there is a clear and present danger to the health of people in this country, you know, which is not being taken care of. There's a clear and present danger to people who don't have a place to live. That, those are clear and present dangers. But the United States is a superpower and a military superpower, and some people are proud of that. And I think we ought to examine that and decide whether we want to be a military superpower. And we ought to ask, if we weren't a military superpower, would be the, and an economic superpower and a political superpower, would be we be the victims of terrorism? Is there possibly a connection between the terrorist attack of September 11th and the fact that we are rich enough to have twin towers and powerful enough to have a Pentagon and big enough to have military bases all over the world which irritate people all over the world, an economic octopus which reaches out all over the world and through the World Bank and through the IMF devastates the social services of other countries? Is it possible there's a connection between America's position in the world and acts of terrorism against us? You know, how come there aren't acts of terrorism against Sweden or Norway or Denmark? Is it possible that maybe we should not be a military superpower? That we should not have military bases all over the world? That we should not have 20,000 nuclear weapons? That we should be a more modest country? Modest countries don't become the victims of fanatical terrorism. Maybe we ought to think in terms of being a different kind of superpower, being a humanitarian superpower, using our wealth and using our resources to help people. You know, after the September 11th attack, there was a story in the New York Times. Sometimes there are good things in the New York Times. They come and they go fast. Really, it's interesting. Things, you know, there's stories that linger and stories that go fast. But there's a story where a reporter, after September 11th, was asking people in various parts of the world about their reaction. And the reactions were interesting, as people in third world countries were saying, "We sympathize with you. This was terrible. You know, it was, you know, we feel for all these people who died in this awful thing." And then they would say, "But you must understand that you are not the first country in the world to suffer the effects of terrorism. That disasters like this have happened in other parts of the world, and even on a larger scale." The man from South Africa said, "Sure, you lost 3,000 people in the Twin Towers and Pentagon, which is terrible. We are losing millions of people in Africa to AIDS, and the United States is giving a pittance to do something about AIDS. AIDS is a clear and present danger to the lives of people, very clear, very present, to the lives of millions of people in the United States. No, that isn't on our agenda." So we have to reconsider our position in the world. I'm just going to, I feel it's, is it warm in this room? Are you running out of breath? I mean, like a... Are we all going to be the victims of asphyxiation? And so I have to stop very soon. But not before I say one or two things more, okay? Always be suspicious when somebody says, "And in conclusion," they don't mean it. "In conclusion," then they go on for hours, you know. There are a few things to keep in mind, I think. Sort of general principles about war. One, when you go to war, the means are certain. That is war. The means are certainly and immediately devastating to human life. There's no question about that. The ends, however they are proclaimed, well, good ends, do this, get rid of this, solve this problem, the ends are always uncertain. War always involves the certain use of monstrous means because war is always the indiscriminate killing of large numbers of people. War is always the certain use of monstrous means for uncertain results. That's just a general principle to keep in mind. Another thing to keep in mind, war is always a war against children. You probably know that the ratio of civilian deaths to military deaths has changed since World War I. In World War I, it was 10 to 1 military deaths to civilian deaths. Then, since then, the ratio changed until by World War II, it was half and half, half military, half civilian. After World War II, the ratio changed again, and now, when wars take place, more civilians die than military. And so we talk about innocent civilians. Well, here's just a little footnote. It's not just civilians who are innocent. Soldiers are innocent. Enemy soldiers are innocent. Who are these enemy soldiers? You know, they're poor, miserable people, just conscripted in the service of this, just as, you know, that's what armies are. You know, are they enemies? No. But they're the people we're going to kill. Here's another thing to keep in mind. When you go to war against a tyrant, like Saddam Hussein, you kill the victims of the tyrant. How ironic, right? You kill the people you are pretending to save. That's who you kill in war. And one final point. Be very suspicious when I say final. When you go to war, you are surrendering what is supposedly a universal moral principle and violating it very, very seriously. And that principle is the equal right to life of all people in the world. Really. It means, when you go to war, it means that the lives of people in this other country, they may be ruled by a dictator or a tyrant, whatever, it means that the lives of these other people are not equivalent to the lives of your own people. You see this operating again and again. We fought a war against Iraq in 1991. At the end of it, there are only a few hundred American casualties. This is wonderful. And when they asked Colin Powell at the end of that war, and he says proudly, "We only have a few hundred casualties in this war." And somebody asks him, "What about Iraqi casualties?" And Colin Powell says, "That's not something I'm terribly interested in." Really. People who died in Iraq are not people we're terribly interested in. The hundreds of thousands who have died as a result of the sanctions in Iraq, I'm not terribly interested in that. So if you believe in the equal right of people all over the world to live, you cannot believe in war. Sometimes, often, I get into discussions of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Because there's still probably most people in this country believe, it's too bad, nuclear bombs, terrible, but we had to drop those bombs in order to save lives. Well, actually, as a matter of historical fact, we did not have to drop those bombs to save lives. We didn't save lives. We wouldn't have had to invade Japan. I don't want to go into the, Martin Sherwin here at Tufts has written a lot about that, and you can look up his work, and World Destroyed is one of his writings, book. But I won't go into that. But when people would bring that up, I would say, very often say this. What if it were August 1945? That's the month we dropped the atomic bomb. We haven't dropped the atomic bomb yet. It's August of 1945. It looks like Japan is very close to surrender. But still, it hasn't surrendered yet. And what if you were told in August 1945 that we could speed up the end of the war? We could get Japan to surrender more quickly if we killed 100,000 American children? Well, the answer that I think Americans would give to that is quite clear. No. Oh, but were willing to kill 100,000 Japanese children for presumably that purpose. It must mean that we don't consider the lives of Japanese children equivalent to the lives of our children. Well, when people are confronted with that, they have to think. They have to think about that. And I think we have to work from the premise set in the Declaration of Independence that all people are created equal, equal in their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If we really believe in that, we cannot make war. If we really believe in that, we have to use our immense resources to help people all over the world and equalize the rights of people to life, liberty, and happiness. And I believe that there's a sort of fundamental common moral sense that people have, which is distorted by the president and the secretary of everything and the media, but a fundamental common moral sense which can be appealed to and which may ultimately save us. Thank you. So,